CB Shuckin' Jazz.
All you racing fans, stand up, clap your feet. I mean, clap your heads. Welcome to the Goat Rodeo.
Live from the CRN studios in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, this is Racing Through History.
And you can't hear me, can you? Now you can. Let me start over. Hello, race fans. Hey, it helps if I turn my mic up, you know. I had my mic down so they wouldn't hear me do the countdown, and they just couldn't hear me. So, hello, race fans. Welcome to this edition of the Goat Rodeo. I'm Jeff Gilder. I'm going to be your host, and let's get around the table and say hello to everybody. While we're doing that, I'll get the live stream embed up on the website. So, Coastal Jack, you start us off, buddy.
Yeah, man. Glad to be back for another edition of Racing Through History, a la the Goat Rodeo. And we got a Carolina race place coming up a little bit later tonight. Charlotte, North Carolina. That's all I'm going to say. I'm just going to let it go, and we'll talk about it later, what year it is. It's modern. It's modern, man.
It's a modern Charlotte?
Oh, it's modern. It's not the 60s.
30 years?
Newer than the 60s.
Newer than the 60s. It's modern.
Is it newer than the 80s?
I'm not talking.
Pin him down, Hugh.
I tried.
So, what up, Bopper? How about you, man? What's going on out there?
Well, I got all excited when Tim asked me about Richard Brickhouse. I've been feverishly.
I noticed the goosebumps coming up as you were talking about.
I've been feverishly surfing the web trying to find. You know, back when the internet first went public, you could find people for free.
Yeah.
Now you cannot find nobody.
Al Gore. You can thank Al Gore for that.
Yeah.
For the internet, that is. Yeah. We were talking in before the show, weren't we?
I wish he would get it back to where you could find people's phone numbers for free. But,
well, you know, that actually happened to me today.
What happened to you?
Brother Dale, I'm writing all the articles for the Back to the Roots program.
Uh-huh.
And one particular individual, I had finally gotten everything I needed on his background, but I wanted to talk to him. So I actually put his name in Google, and it popped right up with a phone number. So I dialed the phone number and asked, was that him? And he said, yeah, he is. So, wow, that would never happen again in a million years.
Wow, and double wow. Yeah.
And double wow. Yeah. Wow, what'd you wow?
You. Just wow. Wow.
Wow.
Wow. All right. How about you, Bopper? You doing all right? Oh, I already talked to you.
Yeah.
Hey, Hugh, how about you?
You good?
Now I guess it's my turn.
It's your turn.
It comes around to
me. I was working on the embed. I got that up now, so I'm free to talk.
Oh, yeah. I'm doing just fine.
It's good, man. Good.
I must be doing good. Somebody referred to me on the chat line as Mr. Oval Crash.
That's you, buddy.
That's me.
Yeah, that Mr. doesn't come up too often.
No,
does
it doesn't. Usually it's
Oval Crash.
Oval Crash. Usually the Mr. is included in some sort of a court action, a summons or some sort of something that you know.
Yeah, that Mr. will get you in trouble every time.
Yeah, when they come at you with Mr., you know something.
You know something. Right. You know there's trouble coming.
Look around and see who is using that term.
Yeah. How about you, Legend? How you doing, buddy?
I'm doing good, thanks. Still fighting that little lung infection I started with a week ago yesterday, and it's been through the prednisone, through the antibiotics, through the cough medicine that tastes like it's supposed to kill you, In fact, I went back down to see the pharmacist and asked her if she was trying to poison me or what with that stuff.
If they didn't make it taste like that, people would be drinking it, you know? I mean, they'd be having it for cocktail.
I know, but this is the worst tasting. I've had a lot of cough syrup in my 71 years, but this...
Are you 71 years old?
I will be next
kid.
Month.
Good night,
it absolutely,
man.
Kid.
I mean, it just...
It seems like it was yesterday that you were 69.
Well, you know what this 71-year-old guy and his brother did this past Saturday?
No, tell us what you did.
We walked the 3.2-mile Augusta road course.
Oh, good for you, man.
Walked the entire track, and I did it in cowboy boots.
Mm-hmm. You do everything in cowboy boots, so don't act like that's such a big thing.
That was a long walk, but it was a lot of fun, and I tell you, if they would take around that one barricade and fill in that one trench, you could drive around it.
Yeah, that's why they done filled it in, because of people like
that's
you thinking
exactly
that.
Right. And Rex White or I, neither one like that.
Are you going to talk about that event tonight, Tim?
Yeah, I can. I had not really planned on anything to really talk about, but I'll be happy to talk about it.
Let's talk about it now, then.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to hear
about
it.
Well, the 14th Annual Augusta International Raceway Preservation Society Hall of Fame induction was held Friday night at the Diamond Lakes Recreation Center in Hepzibah, Georgia. And Ray Cagle, Archie Graham, Donnie Allison, and oh Lord, I have forgotten the other two, were inducted. Donnie Allison was there, Bobby Allison was there, Frank Warren was there, Rex Fite was there, Eddie Sperling was there, Harold Fountain was there, and I probably have left somebody out, but it was almost unbelievable to me, the reaction that Donnie Allison had in being inducted into that Hall of Fame, because he was there and he had his speech ready and he was just absolutely as appreciative as anybody I've ever seen receiving any honor. And we had a good banquet. We had anticipated or had expected 200. We had over that number.
What'd they have to eat?
They had fried chicken, they had roast beef, they had green beans, they had lima beans, they had banana pudding, peach cobbler, rolls.
Rolls.
I don't know, my brother Richard's on the line. Richard, what else did they have?
Man, I'll tell you what, they have some good green beans at that banquet.
They did.
And the fried chicken. I've eaten fried chicken and green beans there before.
Chick-fil-A.
That's good stuff, man. You can't get that stuff anywhere.
Thank God I was going to make it to Philip Walker. And, you know, it was... The fried chicken was absolutely excellent. But we had the awards banquet, got through it, got closed up in time at 8:30 so everybody could have a little social time and still be out by 9 o'clock as we were supposed to be. But everybody that was being inducted was able to show up. The thing that always and will forever amaze me, Jeff, and you know this because you and I have been to a lot of these different things together, the memories of these guys, like Bobby Allison, even though of his injury, Donnie Allison, Rex White, Eddie Sperling, Frank Warren, all those guys I named, their memories are unbelievable. Donnie Allison, unbelievable. Rex White, unbelievable. And the stories they tell and the interest that they can generate just by making a little speech or doing a little talk. Of course, we had TV coverage from the local Fox affiliate down there this year. Oh, Richard says macaroni and cheese was something else. I'd forgotten that, Richard. Thank you. But they were there, and they took full advantage of interviewing the Allisons and Frank Warren and everybody else. And then on Saturday, we had the dedication of the Rex White Memorial Motorsports Plaza and the 5W Kids monument and benches that were set outside. So we actually did the dedication of all that inside because the weather was kind of hot. But there was a little 5-year-old boy there. It was Debbie and Curtis Glass's grandson. And Debbie and Curtis had a medal made up for him and wanted me to present it to him during the ceremony. So we presented it to him up front. He was just as precious as he can possibly be. Pictures are on my Facebook page of all that, but he took his little medal and everything, and then I asked Bobby and Donnie and Rex and Eddie and Harold and Frank and everybody to come outside and let's get a picture of all of them around the monument. So they all stood there with the boy Henry and had the pictures taken. And he was as excited as he could be. It was such a joy to watch that kid. And again, the local Fox affiliate got in and covered it. So even the newspaper covered it. So we got a lot of good press out of it for AIRPS. And I think the day after that, Henry Jones and I were already back and forth about what we're going to do for next year and what we can plan for next year that will make it an even bigger event, because it had kind of wound its way down over the past few years. But it got new life this past year. This year, it got new life. And I think it's coming back. And from what it appears, from what Henry and I have talked about, and I haven't gotten with Harvey and the rest of the officers, but what Henry and I had talked about is what the plans are to start presenting at the next meeting coming up the first Saturday of October will be just really be something. Now, having said that, anybody can join AIRPS. The membership fee is $20 per year. If you live anywhere close to Hepzibah, Georgia, or Augusta, it's really a suburb of Augusta, you can come to the meetings the first Saturday of every month at the Diamond Lakes Recreation Center. It starts at 11 o'clock every Saturday morning. And you'll get to have input into what happens. I think that's one of the reasons that this year we were able to move so far ahead of where we were last year, was having the input of several different people that had not come forth and put anything out in voice or print or any kind of statements prior to that. So this past year has been a growth year, and I think the coming year is going to be even more spectacular than what we experienced this year. But thank you for allowing me to have a little bit of time to talk about that. AIRPS is close to my heart because it's something that, Jeff, what we've always been talking about, keeping the history alive and keeping something there with it. But I'll tell you, walking that 3.2-mile track, and just remember, Richard and I were there that day in 1963 when they ran that race. And Richard, who's got a memory like we were talking about, like an iron trap, could remember exactly which turn, almost exactly where Richard Petty parked his Plymouth when the transmission blew, and exactly where Rex White parked his car when the transmission blew, exactly where in the infield we were parked. I wish I had a memory 1/100th that good.
Wow. I got a question for the panel. You know, as Tim was talking, I was thinking about 40 years from now, do you think Dale Jr. and Matt Kenseth and Mark Martin, for that, you know, those kind of people will be remembered as we remember Rex White and Ned Jarrett and these kind of guys? I mean, do you think that'll happen?
I think Dale Jr., I think his era and back probably will. I really worry about the guys forward of that, though.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, you know, will there be racers reunions 40 years from now that –
Well, that was the dream when all this started.
That Jeff Gordon will attend and say, you know, I'm happy to be inducted into the Augusta Hall of Fame and that kind of thing. I mean, is that going to happen, or is that going to be gone by then?
Well, Jack, what I think is the fact that the drivers nowadays don't care to even be considered to remembered like that. They want to be remembered either in the NASCAR Hall of Fame or either with these 35 million golden parachute retirement packages, and they're not interested in, well, maybe the NASCAR Hall of Fame, but I don't think any other Hall of Fame would interest them, because that's not the notoriety I think they seek. And as far as people like Matt Kenseth or Denny Hamlin or any of those people that are out there running today, you know, even Kevin Harvick, Kurt Busch, all of them I think are going to have a hard time establishing themselves in the minds of people that want to remember the history of racing. Because look at what you've got out there now, are people that don't care about where we came from, really don't care where we are, and could really give a rip less as to where we're going.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you on that. It's just interesting to think about that, the way we look at back at, you know, the Ned Jarretts and the Rex Whites and the Johnny Allens and those kind of guys, and
time changes everything.
Yeah,
though.
It does.
Because
I'm sure it does.
You know, the thing about,
I mean, those guys at the time didn't give a flip either.
Yeah, but you know,
but when now they're involved.
When a guy gets out of the limelight for a little while, he's glad, he's comfortable that he's out of the limelight. But in a little while, he starts to crave the limelight, wonders why they took a camera off of him. One thing for certain in today's world, I think people forget much more quickly than they did 20 years ago, 30 years ago.
I agree.
You know?
Yep.
So I think people will forget them quicker than they forgot these other guys, and they may come scrambling back to be in the limelight at some point. There may be a place for a racers reunion of the future.
I was thinking about that just one day recently, Jack.
Really?
I'm not convinced that anyone will study us, study this generation,
yeah,
rather.
It's interesting to think about that. You know.
You would hope that they would, but I don't know. It's not the passion that it was for us.
The passion is not there, but Alex is a good example. There are those people that do study it.
Yeah,
but
Alex,
but it's going to be a very small minority compared to what the percentage is today that are studying the Rex White era. Mm-hmm. I suppose there will still be interest, but it will be a very, very small group of people, I'm afraid.
The differences are that you think about this. We criticize the fact that they're not driving cars today that look like cars that they were back in the day. 40 years from now, they're going to be saying that's back when those dudes drove cars.
With gasoline.
Yeah. Let's talk about this for a minute. This is funny, how people always assume that a trend will carry through, okay? So it hasn't been 2 or 3 months ago we were having a discussion about the millennials and how the millennials and the fact that they don't drive, that they Uber, is going to affect racing and automobile industry and all that kind of stuff, okay? So one thing that all the people that brought that up to light and made us all aware of it failed to realize is when them little suckers start having youngins, they start looking for Suburbans and stuff like that. So the automobile is not dead, okay? The older older class of the millennials are changing rapidly to what their parents were. You know, that little period of their rebellion and, you know, we're not going to drive gas-guzzling cars and we can Uber and stuff, that little fad passed pretty quickly. It looks like it's going to. So it's funny, though, how we hang our hats on trends sometimes and think, well, this is the way it's going to be. That's not always the case.
Yep.
No, kids and families have a way of changing your complete outlook on life.
Yeah, the heck with my beliefs. I need a Suburban.
Right. and a yard for the kids to play in.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it went so far as that there were developers designing houses without garages because the millennials didn't need them, you know. So, single millennials maybe, early booming millennials maybe, but the older they get, the more they need the things that we had. It's not going to change as quickly as everybody thinks it is.
No.
That's my thought. All right, let's get this thing rocking and rolling. Bopper, take it away, buddy. You need to be first today.
I am. Did anyone see the race in its entirety?
Oh, this is a racing show, ain't it?
The Chicagoland race in its entirety. I must admit, I just saw the last 20 laps.
I saw it all.
I saw the first of it and the last of it, but I'm hard pressed to call it a race.
True.
They were
that.
Just out there running around the track, and I think there's some sort of a fix in for Toyota. I mean, I'm sorry, but the rest of them just didn't even show up.
Tim, I just sent you those phone numbers on your via Facebook.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much. I'll pass them on to Buzz.
There was three different ones, so that might be like a landline and two cell phones or vice versa. You know, some, but hopefully, but of the three, you can... you can find one of them will work.
I'll just send them all three to Buzz and let him find out. You know, I need to talk with him tomorrow.
I got everything. I got email addresses, physical address. Got everything. So
what kind of car he drives now? Yeah. Everything.
He's got a Dodge Daytona that he uses for a street car. Drives it to Burgall every day.
There you go.
At the Paul's place.
The bird.
Does he seriously have a Dodge Daytona for a street car?
Yes, what it says on this People Finder report. Type of car, Dodge Daytona, 69.
With wing,
built by Nichols Engineering. Charlie Gotchback, still mad. It's got that on there. Asterisk. It's got that on in the report. Charlie Gotchback, still mad. He stole my car. But yeah, maybe one of those will work. And what we're so excited about is Tim, I'll let you tell it, but Buzz McKim is interested in contacting Richard Brickhouse.
And that is all I know.
And that's all we know.
He contacted me and said, do you have contact information for Richard? And I said, no, I don't, but I can probably get it because I know somebody that knows him. That's when I called you, Bobber. So I'll just pass it on to Buzz and let him take it from there.
Of course,
Richard, I might just ask him, what does he want?
Yeah.
You know, how much money does Brickhouse owe him?
Of course, for those that came in late, Richard Brickhouse was the unfortunate winner of the infamous inaugural event at Talladega Super Speedway in 1969, the infamously famous race where everybody boycotted, or not everybody, but most of the major drivers, and Brickhouse hung on and, you know, run the race and actually won the race. So that proved to be maybe not the best career move in the world, but, you know, it's hard to know. But other than that, he didn't do anything wrong, which is exactly what Bill France was wanting him to do. But for that, he became the redheaded stepchild of NASCAR. That he somehow stole the race.
I don't understand that.
He somehow stole the race, wasn't deserving of it, you know, everybody else. Nobody knows that. Nobody, you know, the only thing we know is he won the race.
History, all kinds of people that were unsuspecting have won Talladega and Daytona. It's kind of racetrack.
Yeah. Yeah, he might have won anyway. I mean, it's impossible to say. It just is what it is. But there was always a... there was always like an asterisk, you know, beside his name. Like, yeah, he's the guy. That,
yeah, but.
Yeah.
Yeah, but. Oh, boy. It struck me. I'm just sitting here counting on my fingers. That was 48 years ago. That's hard to believe.
But he won the race, but he was also driving a first-class car.
He was.
Car.
Yeah.
He was Ray Nichols' car.
A very first-class car. He was approached Saturday afternoon, which was really crunch time, by none other than Ronnie Householder, who was the head of Chrysler Racing. I mean, what he said was law as far as Chrysler was concerned. And at the time, Richard Brickhouse was a Chrysler driver, not a major tier, top tier, but he was on Chrysler's payroll as, I guess, a secondary driver or whatever. He worked for Chrysler, and he had a contract also with, best I remember, with Firestone. He had two major contracts that he told me that he felt he just didn't feel comfortable telling Ronnie Householder
no,
because he said, I work for him. I was under contract. So he said that Mr. Householder said, we're going to race this car tomorrow, pointing to the number 99, the purple that was on the pole. He said, we're going to race this car. We came here. It's debuted, all the hoopla. It's on the pole. We are going to race it, period. If you want to drive it, there it is. That's basically the conversation.
So there was more controversy on that, though. There was controversy about the finish and all that, too, right? I mean,
yes, there's always been an issue that Jim Vandiver, who also was in the race, was the legitimate winner. There was a scoring error. There's that part of the Jim Vandiver. The advocates of that theory say that he gained a lap or something through some late race pit stops and all of that. So there's that, which is, that's totally non-related to the boycott stuff.
Yeah.
And he was in a non-winged you know, Jim Vanderbilt was always basically just a top tier independent.
Yeah.
But there are those that, you know, that think he won. So anyway, the one that come out of there with the biggest black eye was Brickhouse.
Yeah.
I mean, he was the one
throwing. And won the race.
And won the race. Yep. And the what struck me about the whole thing was after everything was over, neither Chrysler, nor Goodyear, nor Firestone, nor even Big Bill, you know, who had Big Bill's butt was on the line. Mm-hmm. This was the grand opening of Talladega, and he had a promoter's nightmare on his hands.
PDA?
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, PDA.
He had that going, and why in the world did all the guys that stayed, why, that, you know, that never, well, it made the career. That race made the career, made Richard Childress.
Yeah, absolutely.
Put him on the map. Yep. It was his. It was the same thing for him that it wasn't for Richard Brickhouse.
Yeah.
And that's, I cannot connect the dots on that. As to, but Richard Childress, if we could get him on the show, he will tell you right now, that's the most money I've ever won in my life.
He was driving a Camaro, wasn't he?
He was driving a Grand American,
yep,
car.
Yeah.
And he won enough money that he bought some real estate somewhere around Winston-Salem. You might know where it was. The first shop he had ever owned.
In Welcome, North Carolina.
Or either built.
Yep.
That's how he built his first place, was the winnings at Talladega.
He had... He was renting a little shop in southern Winston-Salem. It appeared just to be like a service station. And like you say, he won enough money he went to Welcome and bought a little piece of land. I don't know how much it was, and that was the beginnings of his shop. The old original shop that was down there was kind of built in bits and pieces, but...
That was the beginning of Richard Childress Racing as we know it today.
And he's still, you know, in that area. He's not gone far from there even today.
So, but his Talladega experience has never been a dark cloud, yeah, for him. And he broke the picket. Well, he might not have been in the PDA, but he helped put on the race. He was a Grand American driver.
Yeah, finished 23rd. Now,
yeah.
Bobby Isaac was in that, yeah, race.
He might have finished second, Bobby Isaac. But
Bobby Isaac was
never a PDA driver.
Right.
Richard Brickhouse, in his defense, he said when all this stuff happened on Saturday afternoon with Ronnie Householder and everything, he made his decision he was going to drive in the race, and he tried to contact Richard Petty, who officially resigned from the PDA, but there was so much confusion going on. People was leaving the pits, trucks was going here and there, and all kind of hullabaloo. You can imagine what was going on. He could never get up with Richard to officially resign, at least that afternoon.
There may be some people listening who don't know why the drivers boycotted. Let's talk about that.
The official reason was, in the driver's opinion, the track and the tires did not match one another for the speeds involved, that the track was too rough and the tires too inadequate for the speeds everybody expected to be running, which was basically 200 miles an hour and so on. That was the official reason. In the race, the tires were never the issue.
Right.
In the actual race.
Like they were a few years ago at Indy when, yeah, they couldn't get but 10 laps out of a set of tires. I think that's what they were afraid was going to happen at Talladega, that the tires would simply disintegrate.
So Bobby, you seem to be saying, when you said the official reason, that there's more to the story.
Well, I don't know. There was a lot on the line. Chrysler... And it was no secret. It was well publicized that they were building the Dodge Daytona. They had probably gone public with that in about June of that year. There was pictures, photos, drawings, everything. And Ford had been spying on them as hard as they could, anyway, with aerial photography of the whole nine yards. That part was very well known.
Yeah.
And it, and the Ford had entered 1969 with the Torino Talladega. Which, interestingly enough, when Ford named it the Talladega, there had never been a race at Talladega. The track was under construction in February of 1969 when Ford first coined the name.
There was an awful lot of hype about that track, the coming of that track.
Right, and so because of all that hype, the Dodge people decided, well, we will just debut the Daytona at Talladega. That was, and everybody knew that. It was a lot of hype, a lot of PR, a lot of stuff on the line. And I don't know, one of the leading proponents, well, there were two leading proponents that the race cannot happen because of tires and so on and so forth. One of them was Richard Petty, of course, who was the head of the PDA, and the other one was Leroy Yarborough, who was that year's Golden Boy. He had won every race, or a number of major races. That was the year he drove for Junior Johnson in the number 98, you know, Torino Talladega. They were both extremely vocal opponents of any such race. So they were Ford drivers, you know, fill in between the blanks. If that was the mission, to somehow throw a wet blanket over the Daytona's debut, then it worked. You know,
well, you know, they did throw the caution flag every 25 laps so they could change tires. Do you know that?
If I did, I had forgot that.
I had forgotten it too, but I'm sitting here reading it out of Greg Fielding's book. Caution flag came out every 25 laps so crews could change tires in the 5 days of practice. Leading up to the event, tires had blistered and chunked as early as 4 laps.
Donnie Allison was a major vocal opponent of the race. Which all the Ford guys of that year was them three and David Pearson and Cale. That was, I don't think any of them running the race. Charlie Glotzback, that was the year, of course, Richard had switched to Ford in 69. And the Chrysler group was led by, you know, Charlie Glotzback and Bobby Isaac. Who else? Buddy Baker, possibly Tim. Can you remember 69?
Well, looking at the starting, they only had 36 starters. And some of the people that ran in that was Jimmy Vaughn. Remember him in a 68 Camaro? Bill Ward, Ernie Shaw, Amos Johnson, Bobby Fleming, Bill Arnold. Of course, we know him. Frank Sessions, we know him. Dr. Wilbert Pickett. You know Dr. Pickett? He was in a Camaro. Larry Buck was in a 69 Dodge Dart. Believe that? Homer Newland. Do you know Homer Newland?
One of the Newland brothers. From
I guess so.
Newland,
Bobby
Georgia.
Brewer.
That's old man Newland's boy.
Yeah. Well, a lot of these guys was the Grand American people.
Yeah, they were.
A lot of them were. But it was a, if you were Bill France, it was you couldn't imagine a worse disaster.
Yep.
From a public, you know, it was a lot on the line. People coming in, a new track being open, you know, everything was
kind of interesting. Looking at Racing Reference, the drivers that withdrew from the race, in other words, did not want to start: Buddy Baker, Bobby Allison, Wendell Scott, Richard Petty, James Hilton. The drivers that they're calling driver change, I guess that meant the car was in the race with somebody else: Bobby Johns, John Sears, David Pearson, Charlie Glotzback, Paul Goldsmith. And there's several that did not qualify for the race, but it's kind of interesting to look at that too.
All of this was done Saturday night, Saturday afternoon, and Saturday, because finally they kept having just impromptu meetings in the garage area. Just various meetings were breaking out everywhere, and that nobody was agreeing on nothing. And they finally said, all right, Big Bill said, anybody that wants to race, and anybody, if you ain't going to race tomorrow, get your stuff out of the garage area right now so people that want the race can get in. I mean, it and the first thing that cranked up was the Richard Petty hauler. When everybody, I mean, that was, it took a lot of, drivers were caught between a rock and a hard place.
It took a lot of courage both ways.
Was Charlie Glotz back PDA?
I think so.
Yeah, he did not race in the race.
He did not race.
He's one of the ones that had a driver change. Nichols Engineering had two cars that originally qualified, Charlie Glotz back in the 88, Paul Goldsmith in the 99. The 88 was not in the race. The Dodge 88 was not in the race. There was a 88 driven by T.C. Hunt, which was a different car. But Richard Brickhouse's car was a 99, which I guess Paul Goldsmith was actually going to drive originally.
I think actually in the ensuing years, as more of that story has come out, the original Mule Charger that Chrysler worked with from day one was the 88 car, and they felt it was more durable. It was probably, they thought, faster. Who was originally scheduled to drive the 88?
The 88 was originally scheduled to be
Charlie, wasn't it?
By Charlie Glotzback.
All right.
And it didn't make the race, correct?
It was not in the race, period.
Well, so then they give Brickhouse
the 99,
which was not the car they had worked with and developed so much. So they was probably hedging their bets a little bit too. That ain't the best car we got, but it's still, you know, pretty good. But it was truly a no-win situation for everybody.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it took a lot of courage to, you know, to stand up to the Bill Francis. It took a lot to stand up to Richard Petty in 1969. Yeah. It really did. It was a tough place to be in.
Good discussion. That's not what you had planned, is it?
No.
I'm sitting here thinking all of the unknowns leading up to that race reminds me of the unknowns leading up to the opening of the Dallas-Fort Worth track in 97, when a few days before the race was to take place, they realized that they had zero fan parking. Zero, none. It had rained for 2 weeks, and the entire area around the track was all field dirt, so to speak. And if you pulled off the pavement anywhere in that area, you sank right up to the belly pan. So they had no parking and were expecting a crowd of approximately 200,000 people. What do you do with 200,000 people, cars for that many?
Well, a quarter bomb would have been tickled to death with that problem.
they had that again at Kentucky.
Yeah, but I, having been through that and been there, and seen the conditions and seen how horrible it was, I have to applaud Bruton Smith and Eddie Gossage and the whole bunch for their ingenuity. They, at the very last possible minute, they started to every school system in the area around there and rented every school bus they had and every driver. Then they went one exit down the Interstate 35 and rented Alliance Airport, the whole damn airport.
Yeah.
Told the State Patrol that you route all of the race traffic down to the airport, park them on the taxiways, and load them into school buses, and we'll haul them up to the racetrack. Yep. It worked. And it was pretty smooth to be moving approximately 200,000 people. It all went off pretty smoothly, I thought.
Speaking of going off smoothly, have you got a Hughes Views on the news?
Not really. I'm trying to stretch this
out. Oh, okay. That's good. You can do that. That's good. Yeah. I'm okay with that. I just wanted to make sure. I was trying to stay on the clock here.
No, I don't. I really don't have anything other than I was really disappointed in the last race that I saw. It just seems like that they've lost something. The spark is gone. Do the rest of you see or feel that it's just kind of like they're going through the motions?
No, we all love it.
Yeah, really.
The spark of what?
NASCAR.
I think that left a little bit, a few years ago.
Well, like,
2002.
Well, I read on the official reason the TV numbers for this week was a little bit lower than they had been was because most people was watching the weather this weekend.
There's that, yeah.
Oh,
it,
yeah.
It could have had some slight effect on it. The race fans are going to watch the race. As long as the roof doesn't blow off their house and they don't lose their cable
TV
feed.
Yeah.
They're going to watch the race. They're not, they might, during the commercials, they might switch over to the Weather Channel and check. But they're going to watch the race.
All right, Coastal
what,
Jack.
What was the ratings? I haven't even
1.4.
The stands, depending on which camera shot you were looking at, there weren't too many people there, I didn't think.
They never, the last 20 laps, they never showed the stands. The camera was just cropped in on Truex's car. They just followed it around.
Yeah, that's, just, there by that, the
that's all you could
that's
see.
That's all you could see. And you don't get, when they're so conscientious or so focused on not showing the stands, you lose a lot of what you might see in the race. You don't get any long shots. You don't get any when they're doing their damnedest not to show you the grandstands. They you lose part of the race coverage because of it. I think it's sad that they can't generate any more interest than they are. But I don't know. It doesn't. After having avidly followed it for most of my life, it just doesn't have much appeal anymore. Not like it used to.
So, ladies and gentlemen, that was a report from Captain Obvious.
Yeah.
So,
from Captain whom?
Obvious. Now to Coastal Jack and the Carolina Race Place historic race finish for tonight.
Charlotte.
Take it away.
Yes, tonight.
Can't wait to hear what year.
Yeah.
Look, this is modern. 1981.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
This, for me, this is really modern.
We was all living then.
this is really
we
modern.
We were still living.
Charlotte Motor Speedway.
Yeah, I had to throw this one together in a hurry tonight. Charlotte Motor Speedway, the annual Mella Yella 300-mile late-model sportsman race was held at Charlotte Motor Speedway on Saturday, the day before the World 600 on May 23, 1961. When the 200-lap, 300-mile race took the green flag, the field consisted of, you were talking about Toyotas having a favoritism, 28 Pontiacs, 9 Chevrolets, 1 Ford, 1 Mercury, and an Oldsmobile.
28 Pontiacs.
28 Pontiacs.
That's.
I assume most were Venturas, but
Pontiacs. Oh, this was the late model race. Yeah. Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, that makes sense.
Dave Marcus took the lead from the pole position. During the early part of the race, other leaders were Dale Earnhardt, Jeff Bodine, Mark Martin, and Rusty Wallace. On lap 30, the caution flag came out when Junior Garrett and Tony Cunningham got together with both cars spinning to a stop. A few laps after the race returned to green, Mark Martin was leading when the caution flag again came out on lap 38. Tom Rowley hit the guardrail and spun in front of John Settlemyer. The cars collided, and Rowley ended up taking a trip to the hospital with minor injuries. Mike Potter was also caught up in the wreck, and Glenn Jarrett had to spin out to avoid hitting Potter. Martin made a pit stop under the caution flag, and Morgan Shepherd took over the lead. Shepherd continued to set the pace, but had a close call on lap 110 when Mike Riley spun out in front of him. Jack Ingram was running in the third position in the closing laps on lap 187 when he ran out of gas. Shepherd continued to be in command of the race and was a half lap ahead of the second place car driven by Dale Earnhardt. Harry Lee Hill spun out on lap 197, bringing out the final caution flag of the day. Morgan Shepherd crossed the finish line under the caution flag on lap 200 to win the Mella Yella 300. Shepherd won $16,775 for the victory before 64,000 fans. I think NASCAR would wish they had 64,000 in Charlotte
today.
That was
the late model race.
Yeah, that was
the
Saturday
late model race.
Now, what year was that?
1981, May 23rd.
I was there.
Yep.
I was there working.
And the winner, Morgan Shepherd. driving a Pontiac. It just about everybody was driving a Pontiac. First nine cars are Pontiacs.
28 cars.
Finishing second, Dale Earnhardt, Annapolis, North Carolina, followed by Ricky Rudd, Chesapeake,
Virginia.
Virginia. Jeff Bodine, Chicum, New York. Mark Martin, Batesville, Arkansas. David Rogers, Orlando, Florida. Daryl Waltrip, Owensboro, Kentucky. Dave Marcus, Wausau, Wisconsin. J.D. McDuffie, Sanford, North Carolina. Glenn Jarrett, Newton, North Carolina, and a Ford, finished 10th. John Anderson, Mansfield, Ohio. Connie Saylor, Johnson City, Tennessee. Tommy Ellis, Richmond, Virginia. Richard Childress, Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Dalma Coward, Savannah, Georgia. Wayne Carden, Nashville, Tennessee. Jimmy Hensley, Martinsville, Virginia. Jack Ingram, Asheville, North Carolina. Harry Lee Hill, Lexington, North Carolina, finishing 20th. Junior Nidecken, Pensacola, Florida. Mark Gibson, Daytona Beach, Florida. Frank Kelly. Randy Tissett, Hollywood, Florida. Rusty Wallace, St. Louis, Missouri. Billy Scott, Union, South Carolina. Phil Parsons, Denver, North Carolina. Harry Gant, Taylorsville, North Carolina. Mike Riley, South Daytona Beach, Florida. George Dalton, Charlotte, North Carolina. John Linville, Kernersville, North Carolina, was 30th. Doug Osteen, dirt track driver, Woodruff, South Carolina. Tom Raley, Riverdale, Maryland. Mike Potter, Princeton, West Virginia. John Settlemyer, Conover, North Carolina. Junior Garrett, Tom Usry, Sanford, North Carolina. Tony Cunningham, Hartsville, Tennessee. Bobby Wawack, Villa Park, Illinois. Gene Richards, Chicago, Illinois. And the 40th and final car, Danny Weiss, Asheboro, North Carolina, and another Pontiac, of course. So that's the way they finished. 1981, May 23rd.
Finishing in fifth place.
Mark Martin.
Mark Martin, that was in his initial attempt to be in NASCAR.
Yes.
And this is before the Jack Roush era.
Oh, yeah.
Because he came in,
yeah,
tried it for a while, then left and went back to ASA. Remember, yep, he would soon be gone from NASCAR.
Yeah, he did a great job in ASA. He won a lot of races in ASA.
And he come back with Jack Roush in about the mid-80s.
Yep.
So he didn't, you know, he wouldn't last much longer than...
Some interesting drivers in this field. Like we said, Richard Childress finished 14th in Chevrolet.
Bobby Wawack.
Bobby Wawack.
Name you don't hear in the
history
books much.
Well, a lot of you don't
hear.
Randy Tissett, Hollywood, yep, Florida.
Jeff, do you know Connie Saylor?
Yes, sir.
I was going to ask that from Johnson City.
Yep. Pontiac, of course.
Remember watching Connie drive when I was a kid, 12, 13 years old, King Sports Speedway. And then before that at Sportsman Speedway, Johnson City.
Yep. So.
And was Glenn Jarrett possibly driving was that a Marion Cox car?
I have no, I don't think so. It was number 24. I have very few numbers here on these, but number 24 was Glenn Jarrett.
He had a rather...
And that was the only Ford in the race.
He had a rather spotty career as a driver.
Yep. Now, there was a
Who was that, Dale Jarrett?
Glenn
Jarrett, yeah.
Now, there was a Mercury, John Anderson. That could have possibly been a Marion Cox. Didn't he have a Mercury for a while?
Yeah.
Like a Torino version, Mercury Cyclone, I think, mm-hmm, was what they called it.
Yeah.
But that was the one that Joe Frassan finally blew up, yep, at Daytona, literally blew it in a million
in flames.
Yeah.
Kind of interesting to see some of those names in this,
yep,
race. Bill Parsons.
Lots of old history.
George Dalton. Mike Potter was big from Princeton, West Virginia.
Mike Potter was actually from Johnson City.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, why is everything I see say Princeton, West
Maybe
West
he
Virginia?
Was at one time, but yeah, that's Jess Potter's son.
Huh. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Really?
Yeah.
Number 32, 58 Chevrolet, man?
That's, yep.
I did not know that.
58 Chevrolet.
Mike Potter, he back when Paul was still having his racers reunions up in Jonesboro, Mike Potter came to all of them.
Huh.
Along with Bradley Teague. And
that was cool. Good. Yeah, I like
Junior Nydeck, and he was a big Florida.
Oh, yeah. And they still race in Pensacola, the Nydeckens.
Billy Scott, who was, I'm sure, drove somewhere on dirt night before.
Most likely.
Or either that night. wonder whose car he was driving.
And terrible Tommy Ellis.
Yeah.
Richmond.
I tell you, that was a great era right there for me, you know.
Tom Usry, you know, he has local connections.
Yep.
He drove around here a lot. These guys.
Yeah.
Just those guys, that period of the late model series, late model sportsman series, I mean, it just... That influenced me a lot, I guess, is what it's about.
Well, the late model sportsman series, in my mind, from about 72 to about 82, was just hotter than a firecracker.
But that's what really birthed great Winston Cup era of the 90s.
Absolutely.
That was just the golden era. All these guys eventually made it to there.
Yeah, Harry Gant, Jack Ingram, all those
guys. Rusty Wallace was in this race. Yep. Mark Martin, Dale Earnhardt. I mean, so you can see Darrell Waltrip was there.
Yep.
That's been our argument forever was
the feeders.
The feeder system was so great that the top system had to be good.
Yeah.
Yep.
It had to be.
Yeah, they had all kinds of avenues to move up from, and that made sure that NASCAR at the top two levels had the cream of the crop.
Today, unless you got the big bucks to start with, you don't get a chance.
Yes, it doesn't make any difference, much difference, what your skills are.
Yep. You may or may not have them.
Yeah. But if you've got the money to field a car, you're in.
Yeah, there are a lot of highly skilled people never see that.
Because they don't have the money sponsorship.
Probably more impossible now than it was back then.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Because, you know, guys like Dale Earnhardt, he literally pulled himself up by his own bootstraps. He didn't have nothing in the way of money, help, nothing. He just had desire and talent.
He had the desire and the talent. And back then, that's what the sponsors were looking for, was a hard charger, so to speak.
Yep.
And if you had the desire and the talent, they would give you a try, and if you were successful at that, then look at the Earnhardt story.
Yeah, but now
Martin, for that matter.
Now it don't matter what kind of desire and talent you got. If you ain't got the money.
If you don't have the sponsorship behind you.
You don't get a shot.
Yeah.
Yeah, so
I think go back and just look at all Fred Lorenzen went through. Look at what Nelson Stacy went through. Look at what Larry Frank went through. Wendell Scott, Jabe Thomas, Buddy Arrington, and all those guys, you know.
Yeah, all of those are rags to riches stories that they had. They done it themselves. The sponsorship was the last thing they got.
Yeah,
you know,
they didn't even care about sponsorship.
That was the last thing. Yeah. If they got it, that was the last thing.
And you could go, and I was fortunate enough. I started working at Trot Motor Speedway in 1980, and was privileged to have pit passes and later on garage passes. And you could go during the race and stand behind their pits and see who had sponsorship and who didn't. There were crews out there that the pit crews had on work pants and T-shirts, and some of them, if you were a higher dollar team, actually had matching T-shirts. But you know, and they were working out of a toolbox that they dragged in on a hand truck. And not much else, stack of tires.
See, the early days of the truck series was just like that.
Yep.
I mean, it was. I got to participate in that as a crew member, and I remember it, you described exactly the way we looked, ragged jeans and T-shirts. And,
that's right. The crews that had money all had matching T-shirts.
Well, I can remember when matching pit crews was a rarity in the top level.
Yes,
it
really was.
You know, the Petties were among the first to ever be.
Wood Brothers. The Wood Brothers may have been some of the very first to have matching.
Among the first.
Yep.
But it certainly, even when they had it, it was not universal. Everybody else was ragtag.
Yep.
So when I brings back memories. I probably talked about this over the years at some point, but one of the best memories I had back then was working on Kelly Denton's crew on the truck team as a jack man. We were at North Wilkesboro, okay? And Kelly was fast, man. I mean, we were one of the top two or three trucks in practice and everything. And Jack Roush stood on the other side of our pit wall with his arms folded and watched every single thing we did all morning long. He wouldn't speak. I said, "Hey, Mr. Roush, how you doing?" He didn't even acknowledge me, you know. But he watched everything we were doing. We were doing stupid stuff. I'm sure he thought it was. We were using 2x4 blocks and to take up space in the frame rails for the lead and stuff and switching stuff around. And, you know, I mean, we were a ragtag team, but we were lightning fast, you know. And he was watching everything we did.
Yeah, yeah. Well, back then, you know, you look for talent in all areas, and now it's just that's not so much the criteria.
Yep. Kelly probably would have won that race. Jack Sprague kept bumping him and teeing him off. Kelly lost his temper and ended up not doing so well. But good, those are good days too, man. You know, but that's all changed too.
Yeah, the truck series.
Oh yeah.
Who knows what its future is?
Yeah, future.
Is there
going to
be a truck series next
year?
Well,
yeah, we could start with that question.
Yeah.
And
which, in a kind of sick way of looking at it, I think that would be good for the sport if it goes away.
Yeah.
I mean, I just can't get over the fact that a lot of these tracks have three races on a weekend or long weekend and expect people to pay for a ticket every race. It's just not going to happen.
No,
it's never going
to
happen.
They can't get people to come to the Xfinity races.
Yeah.
And they're sure not going to come for the truck race.
Yeah, I mean, it just doesn't make any sense.
If there was that late model stock race in 81 that had 65,000 people.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Go think about it, Dad.
What was that, an $8 ticket maybe?
Probably.
And that was another thing that people did, and Bobby, you've made reference to it any number of times, and so has Tim. You'd go for the weekend and camp out, and you'd go to whatever races. But like Jeff just said, the tickets for the second and third tier races were $8, $6, $8.
Yeah.
So it was not a big investment to go sit in the stands or even walk into the infield or drive your car in for $2. I can remember many times going to Charlotte, and it was either $2 or $5 to get your car in, plus the price of a walk-in ticket.
Yeah, but what do they charge you for camping today?
God knows.
Back then, they didn't charge nothing.
I know. A lot of places didn't charge anything.
It was nothing.
No, they didn't charge anything out
in the parking lot.
In the parking lot, you could go camp or whatever you wanted to do, and then buy an $8, $10, $12 ticket for the grandstand. Good seats.
Yeah.
But you know, the bean counters come to NASCAR too and said, "Look, hey, hold the bus.
We can charge $100 for
this
ticket.
We can charge for parking."
Yeah. And then we charge $100.
They had obviously never thought of that back in the day. And somebody, we can charge for parking.
I mean, you know, what's a reasonable price for a race fan to spend at a track, including tickets and hotel or camping or food or whatever, for one event, two events, three events? I mean, what's a reasonable price?
Sure the heck ain't $1,200.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah. That's my point.
The market has spoken.
Yes.
I can remember meeting lots of people, especially in the infield, who would pull their campers or drive their motorhomes or even painted up old school buses. And they went to every race or most every race. When you retired, I had met a lot of people that were retired, and that's what they did during racing season, starting in Daytona.
I knew a couple like that. They went to every race, but they went to
I mean, I remember a couple of years, I went to like 10 or 12 Grand National races in a year.
Yeah.
You
know?
Yeah.
And that was a lot for me.
Yeah.
All right, folks, that'll wrap it. Man, this was good stuff, man. I don't know if we had a script or not. That turned out good.
It was all impromptu.
It was all right off the cuffs that we don't have on. But
yeah, good stuff, people.
What
Thanks.
Started all that anyway?
You and Richard Brickhouse.
Richard
Brickhouse. Yep. So,
thanks to Buzz.
Yeah, thanks to Buzz. Thanks to
you. Tell him thank you when you talk to him.
And thanks to everybody. Appreciate all of you. Appreciate all of you that tuned in to listen to us. We appreciate that. And
The main thing is, as always, we really appreciate the men and women of the military that serve so that we can do this. Each and every one of you, good night, and God bless all of you.
Race.